Hello again, everybody, and welcome to this Off the Deaton Path podcast. My name is Stan Deaton with the Georgia Historical Society, and we welcome you to our podcast for February 15th, 2018. As I told you last week, the music you just heard there was very appropriate for today's show. That was the theme to the TV show Homicide, Life on the Street, which was a groundbreaking drama that was broadcast from 1992 to 1999 on NBC. Today we have a very special of a second part of a two-part series. This is the second of a two-part interview I did with a real-life homicide detective, Sergeant Hiram Pete Rivera Jr., who is a veteran of the Savannah Police Force. He is a homicide detective, and you may have heard part one last week. This is a wide-ranging interview that I conducted with Sergeant Rivera in the lobby of the Marshall House Hotel in Savannah. You will hear, as you did last week, background noise from time to time, but I hope that you will be able to hear Sergeant Rivera and the insights about his job, about what homicide detectives do versus what we think they do, based on what we've seen on television, how much of that is real life and what is not, and what homicide detectives do in their downtime. This was an interview that was recorded in Savannah at the Marshall House Hotel on December 14th, 2017. Here is part two. Do you call it the box? You referred to it here a couple of times. You call it the box?
Yes, we call it get him in the box.
Get him in the box. That part of
the camera,
true.
Putting the camera on.
Do you keep the temperature a little warm, keep them uncomfortable?
I will say that is naturally happens at headquarters. It is such an old building that, yes, on occasion it is a little warm or a little too cool. We put on the cameras. We usually call it putting the coffee on. You know, we put the coffee on, that means get the cameras going. So we get the coffee started, and we'll put them in the box. And that's it. We will partner up. Usually, before we go into an interview room, we sit down and go over everything we know, and we try to come up with a game plan with what we're trying to obtain from this particular interview. So every interview in a homicide investigation is purposeful. So we're engaging with people to try to gain very specific information or intelligence, and that requires sitting down and knowing, figuring out what you think this person has to offer. And then trying to develop a roadmap to how you can get that out of that particular person. Every person's different. Every suspect, witness, every person involved, every victim has a different personality. They have a different opinion about police. They have a different opinion about detectives. And how you engage with them can determine how much they open up to you, how much they tell you. So you've got to have this air of sincerity about you, this air of humbleness. You've got to be humble. You've got to be confident. You've got to be able to articulate what you're trying to get across to folks and be able to explain what's going to happen next, because that's a lot of times what people are in fear of. It's what's going to happen after I say this. What happens next? Where do we go from here? So being competent and being capable and knowing where things are going, I think is crucial for a homicide detective to know before you get into an interview, because that steers everything. And if you're not getting where you want to go in an interview, step out, tag team, let somebody else get in there. I mean, it could
turn the heat up a little bit more.
Yeah, I mean, so which is interesting you say that. So sometimes good cop, bad cop comes into play, and we don't mean like bad cop as in like beating them down and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. It's more on tone. Tone, pace, pitch, how we interact with folks.
Do you ever change the way you talk or the way you dress when you're talking to somebody?
Yes, every time. It's interesting you say that. Right, it's interesting you say that. So it's not necessarily like a good cop, bad cop kind of thing. When I first went to violent crimes, I realized that there was a need to teach officers how to communicate better with the public. And this was before body cameras ever came about. It was just this idea of being able to talk to folks in a way that built relationships between the police and the public. Again, this is before I ever even got into homicide. When I got into homicide, I noticed that a lot of our incidents, a lot of the calls we were writing were people in crisis, were people who if we approached them in the right fashion, if we talked to them in the right way, you could calm them down. You could get them to come out and tell you what's happening. You can get them to cooperate. You can gain cooperation, or at, you know, at the highest level, collaboration, which is what you want out of community, is to work them to work with you in solving crimes.
Mm-hmm.
And although everyone knew it was important, it wasn't quite focused on. And that's when I got involved with crisis intervention at the time, hostage negotiation and stuff like that, because I realized that, you know, a lot of police officers, they rely heavily on their pepper spray or their taser or their gun or some other form of control. But they forget that the first level of control is your presence and the words that you're saying. And if we can teach officers how to use their physical presence and the way they're saying things to either calm people down or to gain compliance or cooperation out of folks, then you could avoid using any of those other use of force tools that generate reports, complaints, and other types of things. So I quickly jumped on board. I mean, I was like, I realized that that was going to be the way we were going in the future with policing. And when I went to the training unit after I left homicide, I got into crisis intervention. I got into hostage negotiation, and I put an emphasis on trying to train officers on communicating right. Because if you can communicate effectively, then you can get all of those things out of people that force sometimes,
mm-hmm.
You know, ends up happening. So coming back here as a supervisor, now at this particular point, I realize that the most valuable tool any investigator has is the ability to speak to people, to interview folks, ask them the right questions, to make people feel comfortable, to make them feel at ease with what's going on, and to inform them and to educate them. And when you do that with folks, people are more apt to open up to you. They might not like what's happening, but they're more apt to talk to you about it and to explain what's going on because they want to know, you know, the outcomes.
Because that's the best tool you can have.
I think so. I think the best tool for any investigator in homicide is the ability to know what you know and be able to establish relationships with people to get what you don't know out of folks.
Is that instinct or is that something that you can train?
That is an art. It is not. It is. So interviews and interrogations is not a science. It is an art. And the more you do it, the better you get at it. There is no book, no steps that tell you exactly how to engage with somebody, how to develop a relationship with them. Everyone's different. And it requires an investigator to be able to read somebody on the surface and be able to determine how they themselves are impacting that other person. So when I talk to my detectives or I teach things like interviews, interrogations, and those kinds of classes, crisis intervention, officers, detectives, police have to be in control of themselves. They have to know their body language, know their mannerisms, and they got to know how other people perceive them. Everyone perceives people differently. Some officers have a command presence that is very intimidating. They don't have to do much other than step out the car and take a deep breath. And you're like, okay, I'll do whatever you need me to do, sir. Other detectives have to step out the car, raise their voice a little bit. You know, they might even have to put some air in their chest and put their elbows out a little bit to, you know, give the appearance that they're physically capable of controlling the situation. It's very same when it comes to the way you talk to people. Some people respond to a very calm tone. Very nurturing sort of responses. You doing all right? You okay? I'm sure this really upsets you. There are other people that will respond to, let me tell you what's going to happen here, sir. All right? Because this is the kind of situation you're in, and this is where we're going, and this is what the outcomes are going to be if you do not cooperate in this particular situation. So you can change up your demeanor. You can change up your tone, pace, pitch. You can raise your eyebrows a little bit. You can get into their personal space. You can scoot back a little bit. See, the box is the box. There's no place to go in the box but out the door. You can get into any corner. You can scoot around. You can back up. But I get to utilize all of that space when I interview you. So whether or not I want to increase anxiety by moving into your personal space or backing off a little bit and give you some breathing room, all of that plays into the strategy of trying to gain information or get a confession out of an individual.
And that just comes from experience, right?
That comes from practice and experience, yeah. Because, like I said, it takes you, first of all, taking initiative to get in there and do what you do and be confident. But it also takes a certain level of being open to criticism, sort of a self-evaluation. You know, you really have to go back and look at your own performance. Now, every detective has to go back after they do an interview, listen to it because they got to type it out. So all of them get to see their own performance over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
Not only that, but when it comes to court, there ain't nothing like listening to you, yourself, screaming at a suspect when they play a video, and then you look over at a jury and they're like jaw to the floor, you know, and then the DA has to look at you and go, Detective Rivera, can you explain why you took that approach in this interview? And I have to look at a jury and explain to them that it's a tactic, that it's good cop, bad cop, or that I did it to elicit a response, that it wasn't like I was angry at the guy.
It's just business, not personal.
It's just business. It's not personal. That's it.
Yeah. So do the other detectives, like the ones in burglary, do they recognize and think the guys in homicide are the elite?
They might not. They might not admit it outright.
But they
I will say, when they need something, when they have a question about a search warrant, when they need a search warrant reviewed, or they need an arrest warrant reviewed, or they want to ping a phone or process some evidence or that kind of thing, or figure out how to read tower information or cell information when we extract a cell phone. All my folks in my office, they have the most experience with it. So I will say there are other competent investigators out there. But when there is a need to discuss something that's a little bit more of an intense type of investigation or that requires some additional expertise, usually it comes up to the third floor at headquarters.
Okay.
And if it's not homicide, it's SVU or robbery detectives.
So we talked about the box, and it really does exist. The other thing they had on the show and that you often see is a whiteboard that has names written on it in black or in red. Does that exist?
Yes. So we have a homicide board in our office. The homicide board is a constant reminder of what we've solved and what is still pending. You know, when it comes to homicide and the victims of homicide, every homicide victim, regardless of the lifestyle they chose to live, has someone out there that loved them, someone that cared, someone that isn't going to forget that they lost a loved one to violence. And those boards are constant reminders. So whereas we may move on with the next case, the next political emergency, the next media hype, we're constantly pressing forward. But there's still those folks out there that want answers from things that are happening, you know, that have happened in the past. So that board is a constant reminder. Everything in red is our open homicides, anything that's unsolved. When we solve a homicide, we put it in blue. So it's bluer and black, so we'll change it over to a solved case. And if we solve any cases from a previous year, we put that on our board in green. So when we have a homicide, our homicide clearance rate is usually determined by the cases we've solved in the current year, plus whatever cold cases we've solved from previous years. They go towards our solvability rate. Anything that's exceptionally cleared, so justifiable homicides, do not get counted on our clearance. So if it's a justified homicide, then as something comes out as self-defense or something to that effect, we won't count that as a stat. So that's our constant reminder. At the end of every year, we photograph the board, we make a permanent documentation of it, and then we clear it out and then we start it over for the next year.
What is the most surprising thing you have come across in your experience as a homicide detective? When I say surprising, not like the one thing, but the thing that you never expected when you started this that has surprised you about the job, or has anything surprised you?
At this point in my career, I don't get surprised by very much. Yeah, I have seen just about every kind of tragedy you can think of.
What's the hardest part of your job? It's not the obvious thing of figuring something
compartmentalizing
out.
Compartmentalizing it all. Shutting it off and going home and like being a father.
How do
being
you do
a husband.
That?
It's taken years of practice. Years of practice. Making a lot of mistakes. Going through things with your spouse and with your kids that you don't even know why it's happening. But it's happening. Whether it's a disconnect or miscommunication. Maybe you define as you're a detective. You know, I'll tell you some of the things as a detective you find over the years is you socialize less and less with people outside of the police department. You tend to find that when you go to parties or you go meet other people, all they want to talk about are your homicide cases, which that's the last thing a detective wants to do when they get off work.
You find in that case, I really appreciate you being here.
Yes, there you go. In regards to when I say talk about work, sure. I love talking about being a detective because I love being able to sort of clear up some of the misconceptions about the work. Mm-hmm. But talking about the specific cases themselves,
yep.
That is the details of the cases. I think those are where officers tend to, you know, they don't want to have to talk about it after work. You know, so for me, a variety of different things, combination of exercise. I have a part of my day that is mine and mine alone. The hour before my day starts and the hour and a half after. My wife and my kids, they leave me alone. I come in the house, I get a kiss, I get a greeting, and they let me go get out of my work clothes, go decompress, put my feet up, have a beer, watch a show, do whatever I want to do for at least a good hour, hour and a half. It kind of gives me a chance to, sometimes I'm following up on some last minute emails, making sure things are set up for the next day. And then finally, I can kind of switch gears and come out and, you know, play around with the dogs and mess around with the kids with their homework, stuff like that, ask them how their day was. It's taken my family and I a long time to get to that point. There's a lot of misunderstanding. A lot of times detectives don't want to share. You don't want to bring home all the misery that you deal with at work to the house, so you don't talk about it. So that can be challenging, but it has taken me a while to get there. So I've learned to do that, make time for myself, go to the gym, exercise, have peer support groups. So believe it or not, this is therapy for me. You know, being able to talk with people who have an interest, care about what it is I do, and being able to share the frustrations of the job as well as the things I enjoy, to me that's therapeutic. So yeah, it's a variety of different things that I utilize to kind of help me stay on track, because it's easy to fall off the track, you know, when you're inundated every day with miserable things and crimes and gruesome scenes and people who are sad and for a lot of reasons, you know, that they want answers, they want closure, and the only one that's going to give it to them is that lead investigator. And sometimes that's some of the most rewarding part of the job, is being able to provide those answers. But it can also be some of the hardest, when you can't provide the answers, and that can also be detrimental to some detectives. Some of them, like you asked earlier, some of them are gone because they can't get the reports done. Others are gone because they can't deal with the pressure of not being able to solve a case, to tell a family member that you can't figure it out, you can't make the arrest, that, you know, that there just isn't enough to go forward on the case. That's a hard conversation to have, and you are criticized the most in that moment, so you have to make sure that you've done everything you can possible before you get to that conclusion.
So even as experienced as you are, and I mean this in no disrespectful way, as hard-boiled as you probably are, and maybe inured to the vagaries of human life, are there still some cases that get to you that are harder to deal with, to let go of? I would imagine that there would be.
Yes.
Because you're still a human being.
Oh, yeah. There are cases that you carry with you all over the place. You know, what I have found here in Chatham County is Chatham County isn't big enough of a place that you'll never see these people again. You see them again. And whether it's the grocery store, the mall, you know, out for a meal or something like that, you run into these people. So I have learned to treat people right, as right as I possibly can, and not take it personal, whether I can solve a case or not. Because these very same people that you are interviewing, that you're going after, that you're sometimes accusing, you know, as you're trying to get a confession out of them, you might not get it. And if you don't get it and you don't charge them, you're going to see them on the soccer field, and you're going to see them at the schools, and you're going to have kids, and you're going to see them at these events around Savannah. I mean, and I have had run-ins in the past with people who I've investigated pretty intensely, and have been fortunate enough that they weren't offended by my approach, and they have approached me and have had some very friendly words, which could have very well turned violent or otherwise. And it's been when I've been off, when I've been with my kids or my wife, and I've had to look at my wife and kids sometimes and go, let's walk the other way, because that's somebody in a case, and I can't, you know, we can't run into them, you know. So that can be sort of, you know, the contention that I have to deal with living in the community that you're policing. So I've learned that treat people right, because you press them, and it is just a job. And you can't take it personal. Because if you take it personal with everyone and everything you come across, You won't have no friends. You won't have nobody to talk to. Everybody will just be either incompetent or suspicious or, you know, just a someone who's got some nefarious alternative, the plan of what they're trying to do. So it's easy to be jaded as an investigator and to be suspicious of everyone's motives and actions. But aside from all that, there isn't a better place in the police department to work a case. Homicide is unique. It is one of the few places in a police department a detective can take a case from the beginning all the way through prosecution and see the results of their hard work and labor when that judge finally issues a sentence on an individual. There is no better reward. You can ask any investigator that's been through a trial. There's no better feeling than going home knowing somebody's got 20 years to life, and that a family can sleep easier, or that a loved one has got closure. There is no better reward. And every other aspect of law enforcement, you're always handing off the case to the next person. And homicide, you own it. You own it from the day you walk on the scene. And that's very unique. So our detectives take pride and they take ownership of their cases, almost to the point where you have to remind them sometimes, that's not your homicide. It's the department's homicide. You're going to move on from here one day. But a lot of them take that personal ownership of their cases, and they try to solve them even when they move out of the unit. Those cases still resonate with them.
And I guess one thing that is true on television, you just described, you, the satisfaction of you go home and you know the guy's got 20 years to life, and then your phone rings at 3 a.m. and
yes.
You start it all over.
And it starts all over again. So you get that moment of glory, enjoyment. You know, you get to bask in the glory, so to speak, for just a bit. It starts right back over, you know. And I always tell my detectives, you're only as good as your last homicide. So you may have solved everyone from last year, but if you got 3 open ones this year, you better get to work. You know, so it's a constant reminder, you know, because it's easy when you get that case solved to sort of swell your chest up, you know, be a little confident, sort of, you know, pat yourself on the back. And that next homicide comes and everyone forgets about that last case because you got a lot more work to do in front of you. So it's, you know, you want to keep them, you want to keep your detectives positive, keep them motivated, keep them feeling confident and competent. But continually remind them that we've got to push forward, you know, with the next case, you know. So
we've talked about stereotypes and what people see on television. I will say you did not come walking in here with a fedora on or a hat of any kind. You were not wearing a trench coat. You're very nattily dressed. You look like more like the head of the political science department than at a university. And I mean that I came out of academia myself. I mean that in a very positive way. Well, it seems to me that a homicide detective, particularly in this city, is one of the hardest jobs and one of the ones that gets the least praise, and it can be a thankless job, I know. So on behalf of a grateful public, I would say not only thank you for coming on this podcast, but thank you for all the hard work that you do.
I appreciate it.
All the stuff nobody ever sees, but that makes this a great place to live.
Thank you very much, Mr. Deaton. I appreciate it.
You have been listening to part 2 of an interview that I conducted with Sergeant Hiram Pete Rivera, the Savannah Police Department, he of the Homicide Unit. My thanks to Sergeant Rivera for joining us. We recorded from the lobby of the Marshall House Hotel in Savannah on December 14th, 2017. Thank you, Sergeant Rivera, for being on our podcast, taking time out of your busy schedule to be with us. Our producer today was Al Giardello, and as always, if you have any complaints about this show, including the sound of my voice, but not Sergeant Rivera's, please send those to Mr. Giardello. He'd love to hear from you. Any good thing you have to say about how much you love this show or how much you just listen and love the sound of my voice, please shoot me an email at sdeaton@georgiahistory.com, or if you have any suggestions for the subjects of future podcasts, we'd love to hear from you. Our mailman is usually one Gary F. Taylor, born and raised. That's right. This week, he has been on the personal security detail for Will Smith, who is in town, the original Fresh Prince. I'm not talking about Gary. Maybe he'll be back next week when he's not gallivanting around with celebrities. Our legal counsel this week and every week is provided by the law offices of Gallipo and Taylor, where their motto is, lawyers you'll swear at, not by. The hardest working engineer in show business is our own Brendan Cannonball Crellin, who makes me sound good every week. Our catering provided by Hagee's House of Tacos, home of the Drippy Enchilada. Our beverages provided this week and every week by our friends at the Drost Brewery, where their motto is beer, because no good weekend ever started with iced tea. You can find out everything going on at the Georgia Historical Society by visiting our website, at georgiahistory.com. And you can find this podcast at Google Play if you have an Android, or at the iTunes Store or the podcast app on your iPhone. Tell your friends and family, because after all, why should you be the only one who's miserable? Check out this and other similar painful podcast and other of my musings of nonsense at offthedeatenpath.georgiahistory.com. We thank you for listening. We hope you'll be back next week, where we'll be talking about something else to do with Georgia or American history. See you next week. Thanks so much for joining us. So long, everybody.